The Lara Murphy Show, episode 48.
Welcome to The Lara Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of The Lara Murphy Show. I am one of your hosts, Bob Murphy, with me, as usual, Carlos Lara. Carlos, how are things up there in busy and exciting Nashville?
Well, they're very good, Bob. We've got a nice, crisp, sunny day this morning, and good.
Very good, very good. So, folks, what we're doing in this episode, you may remember in the last episode, we announced that we had a new book coming out, or that came out, actually, that we launched at the recent IBC Think Tank in Birmingham, Alabama. Some of you flew down for the event. We're glad that you came. It's called The Case for IBC. The subtitle is How to Secede from Our Current Monetary Regime, One Household at a Time. And so this is something that the officially listed authors are Nelson Nash, Carlson, myself, but David Stearns also played an instrumental role in the development of the content of the book. And where it came from is the traveling IBC seminar for the general public that we had been putting on for several years, in fact. And just over time, we had developed more content for this particular production that wasn't in any of our written materials. You know, Carlos and I, of course, have all sorts of things that we produce. Nelson's had books and banknotes and public lectures, of course. And we just realized, though, that there was a lot of stuff in here that was not anywhere else. So we put it down into a book. And I would say that if you want some quick introduction to IBC, this is a great place to start. And so all of this is available if you go to thecaseforibc.com. That'll tell you how to get the book. For what we're doing for this, so now we're going to start a series of podcasts here on the Lara Murphy Show and just go through each chapter. So what we'll do, basic format, we'll summarize very quickly the contents of the chapters. So for those of you who don't have the book yet, you'll have an idea what's going on. The episode won't be completely unintelligible to you, but then we'll also dig deeper into it as if we were the authors of a book being interviewed on a podcast, as it were. And so for those of you who have the book and have gone through it, and of course we encourage you all to do so, then this will help give you more of the context or some hidden nuggets that maybe haven't been in the book. So having said all that, we're now proceeding to, you guessed it, chapter one of The Case for IBC. And the premise here is, well, the title is Thinking Like a Business Owner. And this centers on the material that Carlos does in part of the seminar, where he gets this big whiteboard up on the stage and just gradually fills it up talking about things from the perspective of a business owner. So I think, Carlos, it would be, well, again, so let me just give the basic overview and just showing the need for cash flow management, how you've got revenues coming in, but the revenues are uncertain. You've got bills that are always due, payroll, rent, what have you. And then you may have suppliers sending you inventory on unsecured terms. And then Carlos just shows how, because of those uneven cash flows, that the typical business owner often relies on a line of credit from a commercial bank. And then that can put you in trouble when things go south. And you realize just how much control the typical commercial bank has over you as a business owner. And then Carlos says, wouldn't it be great if there was an alternative bank? All right, so I think I've given enough of a summary just so you can see where the chapter's going. You can see the relationship to IBC and what the point of that all is. So Carlos, now in terms of the special features, like when you get a DVD and you watch the regular movie, but then there's special bonus features. Can you talk a little bit about why did you, because this was completely your baby. You're the one that, you know, this came out of the short little seminars for business owners that, you know, you and I had been putting on for a while there in Nashville. What made you take this angle, to rely on your background to say, you know what, I'm trying to explain IBC to people. Let me start by just explaining the plight of the typical business person. I mean, that's, to my knowledge, nobody's tried to do it that way before. So why don't you spend a little time explain to the listeners where that came from?
Okay, well, sure. That is a good place to start. You know, before I go there, I would also like to mention, Bob, that, you know, we put this book together over the Christmas holidays virtually that quickly. And when it arrived and I got my hands on the first copy of it, I actually showed it to one of our authorized IBC practitioners. And the first comment that was made about the book was that, oh, it's not an intimidating book at all. And when I was questioning a little further what was meant by that, it's because the book is not a long book to read. It's probably just a little over 150 pages, if that much, you know, compared to our first book that we came out with, How Privatized Banking Really Works, where we were basically just integrating Austrian economics with the infinite banking concept. This book is much smaller. It's a very quick read. And as you said, Bob, if you didn't know anything about IBC and you wanted to find out what is IBC, I mean, this is probably the book to get a hold of. And you can read it in, you know, just one sitting and get the whole perspective very, very quickly. So
let me say, just jumping in so we don't offend people, you still do want to read Nelson's book, Becoming Your Own Banker, but we do have some material in the case for IBC that I think will help some of you absorb what Nelson's talking about in becoming your own banker more easily. Like I just know for myself, you know, it took me a while to say, oh, that's what Nelson is doing there. And part of the problem was not knowing how to read life insurance policy illustrations, that Nelson has a lot of those in his book. And so so that's what, you know, I was trying to think as we were doing this, the case for IBC, what things would have helped me had someone explained to me before I tried to, you know, understand Nelson's book. So it's certainly, you do need to read more to fully understand IBC, but that's the sense when Carlson and I are saying you might want to start with this one, is that we, both Carlson and I, it took us a while to figure out, as Carlson says, crack the code of IBC. And so we were trying to help newcomers, like, you know, looking back at our own history and like, what was it that made it finally click, and trying to save people time by putting that sort of stuff in this new book.
Right. And so now, coming back to your original question, why did you feel that the explanation of looking at this thing from the perspective of business owners, why is that so important? Well, it comes from my background of being a workout specialist for businesses that get into very serious financial trouble. So I've been in and out of bankruptcy courtrooms a lot, and I know what happens when a business, you know, that gets into financial distress and then happens to wind up in bankruptcy court, say under what is known as a Chapter 11, trying to reorganize, and me realizing that once small businesses, you know, go into the bankruptcy courtroom, the chances of them ever coming out are pretty slim, simply because they realize that in having dealt with commercial banks without them realizing, you know, they got themselves in a situation where the commercial bank literally controlled the entire business. And so the explanation of seeing IBC from the vantage point of a business owner works not only with business owners as they hear me tell the story on a whiteboard by building the scenario out, but it also allows the non-business owner who is listening to the discussion to begin to see that a lot of the elements of running a business apply to running a household. But because they're looking at it from the standpoint of the business owner instead of just looking at it as a household, which is mostly what they usually hear when they're, you know, talking to people in the financial services industry, they're always looking at it from the standpoint of households. The idea of looking at it from the standpoint of a person, an individual is running a large enterprise and realizing what he has to grapple with just to run a business, because being in business is not for everybody. Now, small businesses in the United States, that's kind of a funny term, because as we say in the first chapter, the government very clearly defines a small business as any business that has 500 employees or less. Well, if you're talking about a business that has 500 employees, I mean, you're looking at a payroll that can run into millions of dollars just on payroll alone. And of course, payroll is a business's number one expenditure. But in addition to payroll, another big expenditure of a business is rent. Now, if you just stop and think, if you've got a business that has 500 employees, imagine a facility has to house 500 employees, and you're talking of a major facility. But it also could be a business that has maybe 50 different facilities in different cities. So there's all different types of business owners, small, large. So it could be an enterprise that has a few employees up to 500 employees. And so when we start off the chapter, you know, we begin to talk in terms of how a business owner thinks. And the principal thing that I try to get across is that a business owner, as a general rule, is not interested in financial products. You know, they like to buy assets, but they like hard assets, you know, like buildings and land, and obviously they love cash. And so they basically wind up reinvesting any profits that they make in their business right back into their business, because they believe that this is where they're going to get their highest rate of return. So this is how we begin the discussion in chapter one of the book, and trying to get the reader to understand how the business owner thinks, you know, the type of individual he is, and how he just puts all of his time, effort, energy into his business. And this is all what he thinks about day and night. And we move from there to explain to people that business owners tend to think in terms of a timeline of 12 months, meaning that they start at the beginning of the year, say January and February, and they're moving toward the end of the year, November, December, and their number one goal, of course, is to make a profit. You know, and this is how they think, is along a 12-month trajectory, because what happened last year is history. Okay, it's over. So now they've got to think in terms of the 12 months ahead. And so they need to get to the end of the year and show a profit for all of their work, their hard work. Now they realize they're going to pay taxes on that profit, but they're going to wind up with a residual of some sort after they pay the taxes. And then they have to decide, what am I going to do with this residual that I'm left over with after I pay? Well, they got some choices they can make. Number one, they can invest that money into a building or a piece of land or something like that. Or they can use that residual to pay down loans, perhaps, that they have, you know, in the business. But 9 times out of 10, if they don't have to deal with this first two, they're going to plow that money right back into the business. This is how they think. All right. So I begin to lay out that timeline, and page by page, as you go into the chapter one of the book, you begin to see how that timeline is built up and put together. All right. And so I obviously begin talking about the business owner's number one concern is, of course, the revenue. Because obviously, Bob, if revenue is not coming in on a consistent flow basis, then he can't pay for the bills he's got to pay that are going out the door every single day. So the first thing business owners deal with, of course, is the irregularities of sales revenue, and but also dealing with the fact that they've got to pay expenses every day. And so this is where the partnering up with a commercial bank, you know, is natural for the business owner. He goes to a commercial bank to, number one, to make sure he has a safe place to put his money, you know, from the sales that are coming in. But he's also looking for the assistance that commercial banks provide in providing lines of credit and loans, if necessary, just to deal with the irregularities of revenue. And so this is when you begin to see that business owners are thinking more primarily in terms of cash flow more than profit and loss. And so thinking about it from that standpoint, the way business owners think, which is more along the lines of cash flow, and us explaining IBC from that perspective is what makes business owners get IBC actually quicker than a person trying to manage a household.
Well, that's interesting, yeah, that you say that. And I think we even talked about it like that and how privatized banking really works, like to think of IBC as a cash flow management system. That I know we were using that phrase. I don't know if we have it in the book or not, but I know we've been using that phrase for years now to try to get, you know, someone who has no clue, like, what is this all about? And you say, well, it's a way, if you want to think of it, like using a properly structured life insurance policies for cash flow management. That is one way we try to get it across. And I remember, Carlos, when I was a kid, I don't remember what the assignment was, but for school, I had to interview somebody. And I don't know if it was supposed to be a business owner. I just had to interview. I mean, I happened to be interviewing a business owner, but I can't remember if the assignment called for that or I just picked it. But in any event, it was my dad's buddy. You know, and my dad was a salaried employee at Kodak, so he wasn't a business owner, but his friend was that, you know, he was like a carpenter or something. And so I was interviewing him. You know, I was a kid, like sixth grade or something. And I remember, and one of the things the guy told me when I was like, oh, so, you know, what are misconceptions people might have about it or whatever? And that was one thing he said to me at the time, and I didn't fully understand it. And then, of course, as I got older, but he said something like, yeah, as a business owner, you learn really quickly the difference between income and cash flow.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I was like in sixth grade, I really didn't know what he meant. So, of course, I said, well, what does that mean? And he was trying to explain to me that, like, yeah, I can be working, I can be really busy, I can be selling stuff, but, you know, if I have to pay bills and I don't have any money in my checking account, then I'm in trouble. And he's, you know, saying people who work for a salary and they have a monthly budget and they know, okay, this is how much we spend on groceries and this is the size of a house we can afford and you know, that they don't think like that. Like the money comes in every 2 weeks. They know exactly how much they have. And as long as they're responsible, they always can pay their bills and that's that. And hey, can we go on vacation? No, we can't afford that. You know? Whereas with a business owner, that might not be. It's like, wow, this project's amazing. I need to say yes to this project, but that means, oh, I'm not going to get paid for 3 months.
Right.
So anyway, yeah, that's certainly, you know, the distinction between cash flow and formal income and so on in terms of accounting. And then why the relevance to IBC? Well, because as you're saying, because of that, the business owner often relies on a commercial bank for a line of credit. So I don't know. Can you maybe briefly just explain what that is? But then where, you know, it seems great when times are good, but then what's the dark side of relying on the typical commercial bank?
Well, once again, you know, I think joining up with a commercial bank is perfectly natural. I mean, it's not that the business owner's not thinking right or anything like that. He just realizes that he may be in a certain kind of business where he generates, you know, 60, 65% of his annual revenue the last 2 months of the year. You know, well, that can be pretty scary because you've got expenses going out the door every week, every day. And so, you know, you don't have any money coming in for the larger part of the year. So, you know, who's going to bridge that gap, that cash flow gap for you? Now, you know that once you get to the end of the year, you're going to make a huge profit because that's when all your money comes in. But in the meantime, what do you do? Well, it makes perfect sense, you know, to get with a commercial bank and you know, avail yourselves of lines of credit that the commercial bank can provide. And of course, the commercial banks have been doing this for forever. I mean, this is their business. This is how they make money. And of course, because whether people realize it or not, we all use the commercial banking system as our cash flow system. Every single one of us do. Even if you're just a household, if you're an individual, you get your paycheck, you know, this is where you run and put your money inside of a commercial bank, because where else would you put it? They literally have a lock on where our money goes. And so it is the cash flow system that everybody uses, and I mean everybody. So, however, once you start getting into extending credit, which is what, you know, businesses get into, and as well as banks, they extend credit. When they grant you a line of credit, that's what they're granting you is credit. And so credit comes with, you know, collateral. And so the collateral that commercial banks use in order to extend that credit, you know, can be quite onerous. But business owners that are doing well in their business, you know, hardly ever face that problem. It's business owners that start to struggle, you know, with their business, realize very quickly that the collateral, the constraints on that credit that they've been using, you know, can literally become very perilous for the business owner, and they can wind up actually losing their business when it's all said and done.
Yeah, so I think a lot of business owners in the abstract must realize what you're talking about, but I think, would you say, Carlos, is it fair to say that until you actually go through it, you don't realize how vulnerable you are and how quickly that can jump up on you, and things can go from being pretty good to you're in serious trouble of losing your business?
Yes. A lot of times I like to picture it as you wind up becoming attached to a commercial bank and it works like a dialysis machine, you know, like you need it in order for your liver to work. But once you're in there, you start to realize, you know, how do you get off this thing? How do you get off the dialysis machine? Well, you can't. If you get off of it, you're going to die. If you stay on it and your business is not doing well, you're going to die anyway. So they get trapped. And so when we start talking about in chapter one, how it is that creating an alternate bank that can provide the very same types of services that a commercial bank, you know, provides, but with even greater flexibility, and actually pays you money, and has, you know, tax benefits and no liens on any of your assets, that's when business owners begin to see, oh, you know what? I see the value in this. And so we indicate very strongly that if you begin to see this, that it makes perfect sense to be sweeping any excess cash flow that you have into setting up one of these alternate banks. Because the sooner you do it, the less reliance you're going to have on this dialysis machine that's got you sort of in a stranglehold.
Right. And it's, so again, we're keeping it somewhat vague at this point just to provide the framework and to show where we're going with this thing. But of course, this is pointing the way towards IBC. So this is really just a different way of framing it from the perspective of the business owner to show, like, look at this is the situation you're in. And then notice how, wouldn't it be great if it's when you have these cash flow problems where, geez, this month I have whatever, 100,000 going out the door, but I've only got 70,000 coming in as revenue. And, you know, you turn to this alternate bank, as it were, in order to cover the shortfall. You don't want to rely on the commercial bank. So, Carlos, why don't we just tease the listeners? We're getting near the end here when we probably should wrap up pretty soon. But to keep them listening for more, Why don't you describe some of the attributes of this alternative bank? Like, you know, you're saying the regular commercial bank, they're going to have pretty strict terms about this is the repayment schedule. And if you fall behind, they're going to really get stern and look over your shoulder. And if you're still behind, eventually they're going to take all your stuff and shut your business down. And you and your creditors will get pennies on the dollar for, you know, what they were owed. And the bank, of course, walks away fine. So this alternate bank you're describing, what kind of characteristics does it have is in contrast to what we just described for the commercial bank?
Well, I mean, I'll just mention a few of them, and I'm sure many of our listeners have heard us describe a lot of the attributes of what this alternate bank can provide. One of the first things that, you know, sort of surprises people is that the alternate bank that we're talking about is not one that comes from the commercial banking sector. It doesn't come from Wall Street, that it actually comes from the insurance sector. And so, in effect, that what we're really using here is a dividend-paying whole life insurance policy that basically mimics what a commercial bank will do. And so it's because it is an insurance policy and that it can at the same time operate and work as a tremendous cash flow system that business owners begin to really look a little bit more carefully into this and see, I see what you're talking about because, you know, people think they know and understand life insurance, but once they start seeing that, you know, embedded in every dividend-paying whole life policy is a contract that says that you can borrow from the cash value of the life insurance policy. I mean, it's just a right that the policyholder has. And so long as you have that right in your policy, this cash flow that is building up in your life insurance policy, your alternate bank, so to speak, you're putting in all this excess cash flow in there, you're funding the policy, well, you're able to tap, you know, that cash flow using policy loans. And so one of the distinctive features of that cash value, of course, is that it operates with what I refer to as uninterrupted compounding. You take out policy loans, but the cash value continues to grow uninterrupted because you're actually taking out a loan from the insurance company, and the insurance company is using the cash value as collateral. And so the insurance policy is just chugging along, you know, paying interest, paying dividends, and building equity in the policy. And so you may be taking out policy loans that, you know, may be rolling at interest and that sort of thing, but your cash flow continues to grow. So this is one of the reasons why the terms on these policy loans are so flexible. I mean, it's not at all like the commercial bank. I mean, I've already said there's no liens on any assets. There's no one ever is going to be asking you why you're taking out the loan to start with, like a commercial bank would ask. And so in a sense, you have this enormous flexibility as a business owner to tap into the cash value, the cash that's in your policy, without the constraints of the terms that banks typically use. And so you have freedom there. Because the cash values are constantly growing, I mean, there's more and more reason that are seen by the business owners to why this makes sense to use this particular cash flow system versus the cash flow system that they have been using.
Yeah, and if I could just underscore, I like you, a lot of times what you'll say to the live crowd at this point as you're listing these things is you'll say, you know, and this alternate bank, and by the way, folks, we were saying alternate bank in the book, we keep using quotation marks. So it's not literally a bank in the sense of a financial institution, legally speaking. We're using a term. Nelson's got a good little thing where he talks about when there's a charitable organization that's trying to feed the hungry and they urge you to contribute canned goods to it. And so what is that called? Well, it's a food bank, right? Or the plows, you know, there's a big snowstorm, the plows push the snow. What do you call that thing on the side of the road? That's a snow bank, right? So we use this term bank a lot. Or if you give, if you're a universal donor in terms of your blood type and you'd be urged to contribute to a blood bank, right? So if you just think through, well, how is the word bank being used in all those situations? That's the sense in which we're saying you can set up an alternative bank as a cash flow management system. And one of the attributes of it that I love it when Carl says it to the crowd, because it's, you know, at first it sounds so crazy, you know, like, oh, come on, these guys must be ribbing us here. And Carlos says, and this alternative bank, you know, you take loans against it. You know what? They don't even care if you ever pay them back. And people are like, what? What does that mean? And then, you know, we're later in the seminar, we explain exactly what he means. And then when you hear it, you're like, oh, OK, yeah, that does make sense. But why don't we now, just to tease them, Carlos just meant, you know, I'll just say that officially. And folks, you'll have to tune into further episodes to see the full explanation. But yes, it is literally true to say that if you're a business owner or a household, of course, and you are relying on one of these IBC type policies as your quote alternate bank to fill the gap when you have cash flow deficiencies in a given month or whatever, that those loans you're taking, in contrast to the commercial bank loans, there's no formal terms of repayment on there. And they literally don't care if you never pay it back. So we will explain that in future episodes, and you'll see what we mean. And it's not some rhetorical trick. Like, there's a very legitimate sense in what we just said, and it really does mean what it sounds like. But you'll have to tune in for more if you don't already know the solution. I guess, Carlos, do we have any parting remarks? Because we're over time here, we should wrap this up. As far as what little tidbits do you want to give people in terms of Chapter 1, the material there?
Well, I just, again, if you will get a hold of the book and, you know, read that first chapter and you see the diagram, you'll be able to think like a business owner very quickly yourself. You'll see the business owner's plight. And then, of course, in the rest of the book, which I keep saying is a very short book, it's not a long book, you'll see how it is that this alternate bank, or what we know is IBC, you know, solves the problem. And so this is one of the reasons why we started the book in this way. And I hope that if you get your copy of it, you'll see that we probably use the best approach in order to get more and more people to see, you know, the power of IBC.
Yeah. So I should underscore, obviously, if you are literally a business owner, you really want to check this out, because Carlos is talking right to you directly. But if you're not a business owner, folks, if you're just a salaried employee, don't be intimidated. It's not as if we're saying, oh, this isn't for you, you little peons. This is for the That's not what we're saying at all. It's, believe me, I've seen audiences with many people in them who are not business owners, and they're wrapped with attention watching Carlos when he goes through in the live seminar, you know, filling out the big whiteboard with this, with these diagrams. So by all means, do not be discouraged. It's just, we've found that it clicks with people for whatever reason often when Carlos presents it in this fashion. So where do you go for the book? You go to thecaseforibc.com, and that will show you how to get the book. And we encourage you to do that. Also, share this podcast with your friends, neighbors, relatives, enemies, anybody, in fact, who could benefit from this. Thanks for listening, folks, and we'll see you next time.
You've just finished another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LauraMurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.